Chapter 12. That pony anymore. Amazed at this sudden indifference, I turned all hands out on shore to hunt for him on my own account, or, at any rate, to hunt for the canvas sling which he had round his body. The whole crew of the steamer, with the exception of firemen and engineers, rushed up the jetty, past the thoughtful Elmer, and vanished from my sight. The white fog swallowed them up, and again there was a deep silence that seemed to extend for miles up and down the stream. Still taciturn, Elmer started to climb on board, and I went down from the bridge to meet him on the after deck. "Would you mind telling the captain that I want to see him very particularly?" he asked me, in a low tone, letting his eyes stray all over the place. "Very well. I will go and see." With the door of his cabin wide open, Captain C, just back from the bathroom, big and broad-chested, was brushing his thick, damp, iron-gray hair with two large brushes. "Mr. Elmer told me he wanted to see you very particularly, sir." Saying these words, I smiled. I don't know why I smiled, except that it seemed absolutely impossible to mention Elmer's name without a smile of a sort. It had not to be necessarily a mirthful smile. Turning his head toward me, Captain C smiled too, rather joyously. "The pony got away from him, eh?"
"Yes, sir. He did."
"Where is he?"
"Goodness only knows."
"No. I mean Elmer. Let him come along." The captain's stateroom opening straight on deck under the bridge, I had only to beckon from the doorway to Elmer, who had remained aft, with downcast eyes, on the very spot where I had left him. He strolled up moodily, shook hands, and at once asked permission to shut the cabin door. "I have a pretty story to tell you," were the last words I heard. The bitterness of tone was remarkable. I went away from the door, of course. For the moment I had no crew on board, only the Chinaman carpenter, with a canvas bag hung round his neck and a hammer in his hand, roamed about the empty decks, knocking out the wedges of the hatches and dropping them into the bag conscientiously. Having nothing to do, I joined our two engineers at the door of the engine room. It was near breakfast time. "He's turned up early, hasn't he?" commented the second engineer, and smiled indifferently. He was an abstemious man, with a good digestion and a placid, reasonable view of life even when hungry.
"Yes," I said.
"Hut up with the old man. Some very particular business." "He will spin him a damned endless yarn," observed the chief engineer. He smiled rather sourly. He was dyspeptic, and suffered from gnawing hunger in the morning. The second smiled broadly, a smile that made two vertical folds on his shaven cheeks. And I smiled too, but I was not exactly amused. And that man, whose name apparently could not be uttered anywhere in the Malay archipelago without a smile, there was nothing amusing whatever. That morning he breakfasted with us silently, looking mostly into his cup. I informed him that my men came upon his pony capering in the fog on the very brink of the 8-foot-deep well in which he kept his store of gutta. The cover was off, with no one nearby, and the whole of my crew just missed going heels over head into that beastly hole. Juramadi Item, our best quartermaster, deft at fine needlework, he who mended the ship's flags and sewed buttons on our coats, was disabled by a kick on the shoulder. Both remorse and gratitude seemed foreign to Almayer's character. He mumbled, "Do you mean that pirate fellow?"
"What pirate fellow?"
"The man has been in the ship 11 years, I said, indignantly. "It's his looks," Elmer muttered, for all apology. The sun had eaten up the fog. From where we sat under the after awning, we could see in the distance the pony tied up, in front of Elmer's house, to a post of the veranda. We were silent for a long time. All at once Elmer, alluding evidently to the subject of his conversation in the captain's cabin, exclaimed anxiously across the table, "I really don't know what I can do now." Captain C only raised his eyebrows at him, and got up from his chair.
We dispersed to our duties, but Elmayer, half dressed as he was in his cretin pajamas and the thin cotton singlet, remained on board, lingering near the gangway, as though he could not make up his mind whether to go home or stay with us for good. Our Chinaman boys gave him side glances as they went to and fro, and Da Sing, our chief steward, the handsomest and most sympathetic of Chinamen, catching my eye, nodded knowingly at his burly back. In the course of the morning I approached him for a moment. "Well, Mr. Elmayer," I addressed him, easily, "you haven't started on your letters yet." We had brought him his mail, and he had held the bundle in his hand ever since we got up from breakfast. He glanced at it when I spoke, and for a moment it looked as if he were on the point of opening his fingers and letting the whole lot fall overboard. I believe he was tempted to do so. I shall never forget that man afraid of his letters. "Have you been long out from Europe?" he asked me. "Not very. Not quite 8 months," I told him. "Left a ship in Samarang with a hurt back, and have been in the hospital in Singapore some weeks." He sighed. "Trade is very bad here." "Indeed. Hopeless. See these geese?" With the hand holding the letters he pointed out to me what resembled a patch of snow creeping and swaying across the distant part of his compound. It disappeared behind some bushes. "The only geese on the East Coast," Elmayer informed me, in a perfunctory mutter without a spark of faith, hope, or pride. Thereupon, with the same absence of any sort of sustaining spirit, he declared his intention to select a fat bird and send him on board for us not later than next day. I had heard of these largesses before. He conferred a goose, as if it were a sort of court decoration given only to the tried friends of the house. I had expected more pomp in the ceremony. The gift had surely its special quality, multiple and rare. From the only flock on the East Coast, he did not make half enough of it. That man did not understand his opportunities. However, I thanked him at some length. "You see," he interrupted, abruptly, in a very peculiar tone, "the worst of this country is that one is not able to realize. It's impossible to realize." His voice sank into a languid mutter. "And when one has very large interests. Very important interests." He finished, faintly up the river. We looked at each other. He astonished me by giving a start and making a very queer grimace. "Well, I must be off," he burst out, hurriedly. "Oh, long." At the moment of stepping over the gangway he checked himself, though, to give me a mumbled invitation to dine at his house that evening with my captain, an invitation which I accepted. I don't think it could have been possible for me to refuse. I like the worthy folk who will talk to you of the exercise of free will, at any rate for practical purposes. Free, is it? For practical purposes. Bosh! How could I have refused to dine with that man? I did not refuse, simply because I could not refuse. Curiosity, a healthy desire for a change of cooking, common civility, the talk and the smiles of the previous 20 days, every condition of my existence at that moment and place made irresistibly for acceptance. And, crowning all that, there was the ignorance, I say the fatal want of foreknowledge to counterbalance these imperative conditions of the problem. A refusal would have appeared perverse and insane. Nobody, unless a surly lunatic, would have refused. But if I had not got to know Elmayer pretty well, it is almost certain there would never have been a line of mine in print. I accepted then, and I am paying, yet the price of my sanity. The possessor of the only flock of geese on the East Coast is responsible for the existence of some 14 volumes, so far. The number of geese he had called into being under adverse climatic conditions was considerably more than 14. The tale of volumes will never overtake the counting of heads, I am safe to say, but my ambitions point not exactly that way, and whatever the pangs the toil of writing has cost me, I have always thought kindly of Elmayer. I wonder, had he known anything of it, what his attitude would have been. This is something not to be discovered in this world. But if we ever meet in Elysian fields, where I cannot depict him to myself otherwise than attended in the distance by his flock of geese, birds sacred to Jupiter, and he addresses me in the stillness of that passionless region, neither light nor darkness, neither sound nor silence, and heaving endlessly with billowy mists from the impalpable multitudes of the swarming dead, I think I know what answer to make. I would say, after listening courteously to the unvibrating tone of his measured remonstrances, which should not disturb, of course, the solemn eternity of stillness in the least, I would say something like this. It is true, Almayer, that in the world below I have converted your name to my own uses. But that is a very small larceny. What's in a name, O shade? If so much of your old mortal weakness clings to you, yet as to make you feel aggrieved, it was the note of your earthly voice, Almayer. Then, I entreat you, seek speech without delay with our sublime fellow shade, with him who, in his transient existence as a poet, commented upon the smell of the rose. He will comfort you. You came to me stripped of all prestige by men's queer smiles, and the disrespectful chatter of every vagrant trader in the islands. Your name was the common property of the winds. It, as it were, floated naked over the waters about the equator. I wrapped round its unhonored form the royal mantle of the tropics, and have essayed to put into the hollow sound the very anguish of paternity feats which you did not demand from me, but remember that all the toil and all the pain were mine. In your earthly life you haunted me, Almayer. Consider that this was taking a great liberty. Since you were always complaining of being lost to the world, you should remember that, if I had not believed enough in your existence to let you haunt my rooms in Bessborough Gardens, you would have been much more lost. You affirm that had I been capable of looking at you with a more perfect detachment and a greater simplicity, I might have perceived better the inward marvelousness which, you insist, attended your career upon that tiny pinpoint of light, hardly visible far, far below us, where both our graves lie. No doubt. But reflect, O complaining shade, that this was not so much my fault as your crowning misfortune. I believed in you in the only way it was possible for me to believe. It was not worthy of your merits? So be it. But you were always an unlucky man, Almayer. Nothing was ever quite worthy of you. What made you so real to me was that you held this lofty theory with some force of conviction, and with an admirable consistency. It is with some such words translated into the proper shadowy expressions that I am prepared to placate Almayer in the Elysian abode of shades, since it has come to pass that, having parted many years ago, we are never to meet again in this world. V. In the career of the most unliterary of writers, in the sense that literary ambition had never entered the world of his imagination, the coming into existence of the first book is quite an inexplicable event. In my own case, I cannot trace it back to any mental or psychological cause which one could point out and hold to. The greatest of my gifts, being a consummate capacity for doing nothing, I cannot even point to boredom as a rational stimulus for taking up a pen. The pen, at any rate, was there, and there is nothing wonderful in that. Everybody keeps a pen, the cold steel of our days, in his rooms, in this enlightened age of penny stamps and halfpenny postcards. In fact, this was the epoch when by means of postcard and pen Mr. Gladstone had made the reputation of a novel or two. And I too had a pen rolling about somewhere, the seldom used, the reluctantly taken up pen of a sailor ashore, the pen rugged with the dried ink of abandoned attempts, of answers delayed longer than decency permitted, of letters begun with infinite reluctance, and put off suddenly till next day, till next week, as like as not. The neglected, uncared for pen, flung away at the slightest provocation, and under the stress of dire necessity hunted for without enthusiasm, in a perfunctory, grumpy worry, in the here the devil is the beastly thing gone to, ungracious spirit. Where, indeed, it might have been reposing behind the sofa for a day or so. My landlady's anemic daughter as a lender would have expressed it, though commendably neat, had a lordly careless manner of approaching her domestic duties. Or it might even be resting delicately poised on its point by the side of the table leg, and when picked up show a gaping, inefficient beak which would have discouraged any man of literary instincts. But not me. Ever mind. This will do. Oh, days without guile. If anybody had told me then, that a devoted household, having a generally exaggerated idea of my talents and importance, would be put into a state of tremor and flurry by the fuss I would make, because of a suspicion, that somebody had touched my sacrosanct pen of authorship, I would have never deigned as much as the contemptuous smile of unbelief. There are imaginings too unlikely for any kind of notice, too wild for indulgence itself, too absurd for a smile. Perhaps, had that seer of the future been a friend, I should have been secretly saddened. Loss. I would have thought, looking at him with an unmoved face, the poor fellow is going mad. I would have been, without doubt, saddened. For in this world, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.